It's The Record from KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Last week, a young man named Aaron Ibarra walked onto the Seattle Pacific University campus and opened fire. He killed one person, wounded two others, and reports indicate that this shooter was a hunter. He'd acquired his guns legally. Voters have a chance to weigh in on Washington State's gun laws in November. Two initiatives are going to appear on the ballot, and this is where it gets a little bit confusing. I-591 keeps law enforcement from searching gun owners' homes for firearms. I-594 would put criminal background checks in place for people who acquire guns through a transfer of ownership or buy guns at gun shows. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins is here to help sort out state law when it comes to guns. Hey, Austin.
Hi, Marcy. Good afternoon.
Let's start with the basics. What is the process right now to legally acquire a gun here?
Well, maybe we should even back up one step and just remind you that Washington's Constitution is very clear about the right of gun ownership. In fact, our language in our state constitution would appear to be even stronger than the federal constitution. And that language is the right of the individual citizen to bear arms in defense of himself or the state shall not be impaired. That's what the Washington Constitution says. So to answer your question, the process for legally acquiring a gun is pretty simple. It's driven by the federal Brady law and by state law. If it's a rifle or a shotgun, and if you're going through a licensed firearm dealer, then there's a federal form that's completed. The dealer conducts a national instant criminal background check. If there are no red flags, there is no waiting period. You basically can walk into the store, purchase that rifle or shotgun, and walk out the door with it. If it's a handgun, and again, you're going through a licensed dealer, there's going to be both a federal and a state application required. If you are not a concealed pistol license holder, there will be a 5-day waiting period. If you have that CPL, then there's no waiting period, but that state-level background check, in addition to the federal instant background check, will still be conducted.
Is there any caveats for or any kind of place to ask what you plan to do with your gun? In other words, is there a distinction between hunting and self-protection on any of these forms?
No, the distinction is about what kind of firearm is it? You know, the rifles and shotguns sort of in one category, the handguns in another category.
And semi-automatic weapons?
Same thing. I specifically asked that question. So if it's a semi-automatic military-style rifle, that's still in the rifle category, not the handgun category. So rifles and shotguns, they're one. Pistols are another.
Pistols are another. Okay, so let's go to these two initiatives that will face voters in November. Let's start with the one that I suppose is put out by proponents of gun rights, I-591. What is that?
Right, and so you've got essentially two competing or dueling measures on the ballot, and they're basically do the opposite thing. Initiative 591 prohibits the state government, as you mentioned in the lead-in, from confiscating guns, but it also basically says that we can't adopt as a state a stricter background check policy or law than any uniform national standard. So that's, you know, it's looking to a uniform national requirement for background checks. Initiative 594, which gets at the sort of quote unquote loophole in the law that I just described, mm-hmm. which is that if you're dealing with a licensed firearm dealer, then you're going to have those background checks. If you were doing a person-to-person sale, whether that's at a gun show, whether that's somebody you meet on arms list or some other manner, but if it's person-to-person, these background checks don't apply. 594 aims to deal with that issue and basically would apply the same background checks I described to all firearm sales and transfers, although there are several exceptions to that. So you really have two dueling measures on the ballot.
Austin Jenkins, you mentioned something that I've not heard of, arms list.
Well, that's like Craigslist for guns, and there are others like that, but Craigslist doesn't actually accept postings for guns, firearms. So there have been other sort of online venues that have cropped up where people can do this, essentially identify each other, buyer, potential seller, and then go meet somewhere and do the transaction.
Are the sellers regulated?
No. Again, this is, you know, if you're not a licensed firearm dealer, if you're doing this as an individual, you're not doing it regularly, you don't have to be licensed. And that's, again, what 594 would say is even among individuals, that would trigger the background check. Now, of course, if that were the law, you also have enforcement issues. Who's going to enforce it? How would you find out that somebody hadn't done that? But nonetheless, the gap in the law as these proponents of 594 see it right now is there's a pretty easy avenue to avoid the background checks.
What happens if both of these initiatives pass?
It's a very good question, and it hasn't happened before. We've had dueling initiatives, for instance, on medical malpractice on the ballot, and typically, kind of politically, historically, what happens is voters see these competing ideas and they just reject both of them. I talked to David Ammons in the Secretary of State's office just a short while ago. He said if they both did pass, the legislature could deal with that. It would take a two-thirds vote because you can't amend these things within the first 2 years, but they could try to harmonize them. Hard to imagine they would do that in this case because there's not much similarity. In California, apparently, the one that got the most votes wins. But the guess here is that probably this would end up at the state Supreme Court, and the courts would try to figure it out.
Austin Jenkins is our Olympia correspondent. Thanks for joining us today, Austin.
You're welcome.
Last week, Aaron Ibarra's attorney said Ibarra had been treated for a longstanding mental illness. Tomorrow, we're going to look at what kind of support the state of Washington provides and doesn't provide for people who suffer from long-term mental illness. You're with The Record on KUOW.